Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, Creation and Evolution, Part 10. For more resources from Dr. Craig, go online to reasonablefaith.org.
We've been looking at the functional interpretation of Genesis 1, according to which Genesis 1 is a description not of the material creation of the biosphere, but simply God's assigning functions to various things in the world so that the world or the cosmos becomes his temple in which he takes residence finally on the seventh day. And I've argued against the plausibility of a purely functional interpretation of Genesis 1 and of the idea that God's Sabbath rest is meant to be simply a residing of God in his cosmic temple. I do need to make one corrective, though, to something I said last week. I believe last week I said that the 7 days in Genesis 1 should not be interpreted as a reflection of the 7 days of dedication of Solomon's temple, because this was a motif that was common in ancient creation myths. In fact, I misstated that. The 7-day motif is not common in ancient creation myths, but it is a very common motif throughout the ancient world, used in many different ways, so that it would be a mistake to point to the 7 days of dedication of Solomon's temple in particular as the source of this 7-day motif. This point was made well by Miller and Soden, whose view we're going to consider next. This is what they write. There is no known record of any other society framing creation in 7 days, though 7 days might be involved, for example, in the creation of man or other aspects of the creation story, so that the use of it in Genesis 1 does not appear to be directly dependent upon Israel's ancient Near Eastern mindset. The use of a 7-day period of time, however, commonly occurs in ancient Near Eastern mythology, legend, and cultic practice. For example, it occurs to describe an appropriate approach to the gods. It provides a framework for a divinely ordained and successful mission to find a royal wife to bear a son. It describes a 7-day waiting period in which the anticipated event occurs on the 7th day. The number 7 was also frequently used for many other things in the ancient texts, and even in the Hebrew Old Testament, and was not always intended to be a literal number. Instead, it carried symbolic significance, being generally understood to express the ideas of completion, perfection, or fulfillment. So given the widespread use of this 7-day motif in the ancient Near East, I think it would be a mistake to simply assume that it refers to this 7-day period of temple dedication preceding Solomon's inaugurating the temple. In fact, quite the contrary, that 7-day waiting period would itself be a reflection of the very widespread and symbolic use of the number 7 throughout the ancient Near East. So, in summary then, I find the functional interpretation of Genesis 1 to be quite implausible. It seems to me that the account in Genesis 1 is most naturally taken to involve what Walton calls both material creation and functional creation, both creating the entities described as well as assigning their functions. Now, we want to wrap up our discussion of the functional interpretation by seeing Walton's response to this suggestion. He raises the question, couldn't it be both? Couldn't it be both material creation and functional creation? And he gives 4 reasons for rejecting that view. I think, however, these 4 reasons can be answered very quickly in light of what we've already seen. First reason, he says, is that days 1, 3, and 7 have no statement of creation of any material component. Days 1, 3, and 7 have no statement of creation of any material component. Well, by way of response, I would say this, is, of course, isn't surprising, for day 7, that's God's day of rest on which he ceases from creation. But on day 1, light is created, So that certainly involves material creation. And on day three, vegetation and fruit trees are created. So it seems to me simply false to say that material creation isn't involved on days one and three. Number two, he says, day two has a potentially material component, namely the firmament. But he says, and I quote, if this were a legitimate material account, then we would be obliged to find something up there, end quote. Then there would have to be this solid dome up there, and there isn't. Well, by way of response, I would say again, this is concordism, as we saw. If the ancient Israelites thought that the firmament was solid, then they would have no problem relating an account of its material creation. So it seems to me that this second answer, reason, is not a very good reason for interpreting it purely functionally. He's letting scientific concordism guide his exegesis, which he himself admits is illegitimate. His third reason is that days four and six deal explicitly only with material components on a functional level. Days four and six deal explicitly with material components only on a functional level. Well, by way of response, I would say that might be the case for the sun, moon, and stars, where their functions are specified for marking days and months and seasons and years. But it is clearly false with regard to the animals. The text says, let the earth bring forth living creatures. And it's also probably false with respect to man. The text says, let us make man in our image, since man wasn't included among the animals. He wasn't already there, and therefore the making of man would imply the material creation of something new. So it seems to me, again, false that days four and six deal with these material components only functionally. It does envision, I think, their coming into existence. And finally, his fourth reason is that on day five, functions are mentioned and the word bara, to create, is used. On day five, functions are mentioned and the word bara is used. By way of response, we've seen that bara involves efficient causation, producing the effect in being. And the material origins of birds and sea creatures on day five is clearly in view. So that it's just simply false that this is purely functional. On day five, the birds and the sea creatures are created by God. So I don't think any of these reasons are at all persuasive to suggest that the account in Genesis 1 should not be read as both material creation and functional creation as well. Now, there's a good deal more I'd love to say about Walton's book, but I've taxed your patience already, I suspect. And I think that this is sufficient to show that the functional interpretation is not a very plausible option for the interpretation of the opening chapter of Genesis. Any discussion of the functional interpretation before we move on to our next interpretation? Yes, James.
Bill, I just have a question in general about this. You've spent a lot of time on this, and I think you've done a good job of picking apart the theory. But I wonder why. Is this because this is something that's starting to catch on at an academic level or popular level? Is there a reason?
Yes, there are two reasons, as I said, James, that I shared right at the very beginning. One is because I have just read Walton's book, and so it's very fresh in my mind, and I got all worked up about it and over-exercised. If maybe in 2 years' time I would cover this section, maybe I wouldn't spend so much time on it. But the freshness of it in my mind is one reason, frankly. But then in addition to that, this interpretation is one to which a certain segment of evangelical theology appeals in order to reconcile science and religion. Perhaps you've heard of Francis Collins, the head of the Human Genome Project, who is a theistic evolutionist, or as he prefers, creative evolution, and his BioLogos Foundation, which is attempting to provide a sort of alternative to young earth creationism. They get a lot of funding from the Templeton Foundation, which wants to promote the dialogue between science and religion. The book carries an endorsement on its rear cover from Francis Collins, and I think that this interpretation is one that is increasingly influential in the evangelical community as a way of reconciling science and religion. If the interpretation of Genesis 1 or the meaning of Genesis 1 is purely functional, then there can't be any conflict with science, because it's not about how these things came into existence. It's just about God saying, well, this will be for that purpose and this will be for that purpose. And as Walton says, the dinosaurs and everything else could have been flourishing and existing long before Genesis 1:1 began. So I do think this is a very important interpretation in that sense, as well as the next one that we're going to talk about, which is also now very much in the mix of this discussion. Dennis.
Bill, I've read some of the writings of Francis Collins, Carl Gilbertson, and others who seem to have no problem at all with scientific concordism and the, you know, exegesis of scriptures, you know, or Gilbertson maybe. I don't know so much.
Yeah, I don't think that's right, Dennis. Let's define again what we are meaning by concordism. I don't like the word, but it's become standard terminology today in these sorts of discussions, and so one uses it simply because you want to make sure you're all talking on the same page. Concordism does not mean that science and the Bible are in concord with each other, that there's a harmony between science and the Bible. I think we all hope that that is true, that there's concord between science and religion. But when these scholars talk about concordism, this is descriptive of a certain hermeneutical approach to the text, which says you use modern science to guide you as you read the text, and you try to interpret the text in light of modern science. I think the most obvious example of this kind of hermeneutic would be Hugh Ross. Hugh Ross reads the text in light of modern Big Bang cosmology and evolutionary theory. For example, when the scripture says that God stretched out the heavens, Ross interprets that to mean that this is the expansion of space that is predicted in the standard Big Bang model, that the metaphor of stretching out the heavens is meant to be literally the expansion of space, and he will read other elements of the scientific picture back into the text. And what people like Walton and Blochet and many others are protesting is that that's not a legitimate hermeneutical approach to the text. The proper way to approach a text is to try to discern what the original author meant when he said it, and how the original audience to whom it was written would have understood it. And that is the correct way to get at the text. Otherwise, you run the risk of importing all kinds of things into the text. And indeed, each successive generation would import its science back into the text, and the text would constantly be changing in its meaning as each successive generation tries to read its modern science into the text. Instead, you should let the text stand on its own and try to understand it within its original horizon, so to speak. How would its author and its audience have understood it? And I think that's correct. I think that that is the right hermeneutical approach. Right. And so in that sense, Francis Collins and Gilbertson are not concordists, quite the opposite. They would say we shouldn't try to read the text in light of modern science.
Okay, well, thank you for that. That clarifies a great deal.
Okay, good. Some other comment? Yes, Brad.
I always get confused when we talk about what the original author meant and what the original audience would have interpreted this, when we talk about Revelation in the Bible, because and I like to distinguish science, forensic science of this is what probably happened in the past that we cannot replicate over and over again, from science that can be a theory that can be proven and replicated and all of that. So I think there's a different standard between those two. Isn't the Bible written for us today? And should we not, I mean, God's intent when he wrote or directed the writing of the Bible to be a communication to us today?
Well, certainly. But not just to us today.
Right,
it is written for all persons of all times and cultures. And in order to interpret it properly, you need to try to understand especially the original literary genre in which it was written. For example, if you approach the book of Revelation as a book of history, then you think that in the future there's going to be giant seven-headed sea monsters crawling up out of the ocean, and sort of like Godzilla attacks New York, it's going to look like that in the future. But if you understand Jewish apocalyptic literature, you understand that these are symbols, and that in apocalyptic literature, you have all of this sort of symbolic representation of political entities and so forth, that it isn't to be taken as though it were a kind of grade B horror movie with all of these monsters and so forth. And similarly, when you read poetry in the Old Testament, like the Psalms, you need to interpret them according to the proper literary genre. On the other hand, if you're reading the book of Acts, that would be historical writing, and there you would want to understand it. Though, again, importantly, Brad, you would need to see how do ancient historians write, because there are significant differences between ancient history and modern history. For example, ancient historians didn't always emphasize the chronology of events. They felt free to group the events thematically, and so move them around, and not necessarily narrate them just in chronological succession. So I think it's important to remember that although the Bible is written for every generation and is inspired by God, it is written through the instrumentality of human beings who reflect their time and culture and thought forms. And so in order to interpret them correctly, we need to put ourselves back in their shoes and ask, how would a first century Jew have read, say, the book of Revelation or the book of Genesis? So it is for every generation, that's right, but we need nevertheless to exercise care in how we interpret it, I think. Yes, Taiwan?
I wonder why we have to map that with Aristotle's framework. Can we not map it with material creation, functional creation, and purpose behind the creation? Mm-hmm. Because the seventh day is God enter into rest. And in Hebrew chapter 4, it says very clearly that God promised us to enter into the rest.
Yes.
So purposely, we are to enter into rest with God. And the way that we go into this rest is that we utilize the context to take dominion of all his creation in agreement with the content, in agreement with the context. And I thought if we accept his context and we accept the boundary he established, then that's the fear of the Lord, which is the wisdom that will take us into that rest with him by promise.
Yes.
And so can we not look at that in this three level, just as a person has body, soul, and spirit, so the creation has material function and purpose?
Well, now, function is really what Walton means by purpose. The function of a hammer, say, is to pound nails. The function of a knife is to cut. So when he talks about functional creation, he means specifying the purpose. Now, with respect to material creation, the only reason I appealed to Aristotle there was for a clarification of terminology. That's all. Just the terminology I found confusing, because when you think of the words material creation, that sounds like the creation of material things, of material objects. And so when Walton sees how the word bara is used sometimes in the Old Testament, it's talking about the creation of things that are not material objects, like create in me a pure heart, O God. It's not asking him to make some organ inside of your body. Or when it says God creates disaster, or God creates north and south. These are not material entities. And so Walton thinks, this isn't material creation. This is functional creation. Well, that's because he's misunderstood what material creation really is. It means efficient causation. When God creates a chair, he brings the chair into being. When he creates disaster, he brings disaster into being. When he creates a pure heart, he's the efficient cause of your having a pure heart. So I was simply eager to clarify the terminology, because I think because of the misleading terminology, he is led to a misinterpretation or misunderstanding of the word bara as not involving efficient causation. And it seems to me very evidently that it is efficient causation. God brings into being heavens and earth, the sea creatures on day five, man on day six. So that was the reason I appealed to Aristotle's terminology, simply because I thought it could bring some clarity. Okay. But I like your point about God's resting on the seventh day. Certainly, the remainder of the Old Testament and the New Testament interpret God's resting on the seventh day as his ceasing from creative activity. And that's why Israel rests on the Sabbath. They don't do any work on the Sabbath day. The Sabbath day or the seventh day isn't the day in which God comes to reside in his cosmic temple. It's the day on which he ceases from his creative work. And that establishes the basis for Israel's Sabbath practices too.
Not only the practice, but we are called to enter into the rest with God as a as our pilgrim, the end, as a goal of our pilgrimage.
I see. Yes, that's true.
Right, and also the gap, and in Hebrew, it's clear that those that cannot enter into God's rest is because of the faith issue. They
yes.
don't have the faith. That means they do not accept God's context or his purpose. And God's creative purpose was distorted when Satan comes in and tempts Adam and Eve. So there are, just as there are two wisdom, one is godly wisdom, one is man's imitation of wisdom, which is worldly wisdom, so there are two purposes. One is God's creative purpose. One is man's interpretive purpose after eating the fruit from the tree of knowledge.
Well, I'm not concerned to examine in detail what God's purposes might be. And what we're just interested in here understanding is, when we look at the first chapter of Genesis, is this just purely functional, or is it both functional and what he calls material creation? Anybody else have a comment on this view?
Thank you.
Yes. All right, let's go on then to number 8, which I'm going to call the Hebrew creation myth interpretation. The Hebrew creation myth interpretation. Miller and Soden, in their new book, In the Beginning, We Misunderstood, 2012, lay out this interpretation of Genesis chapter 1. Though they do not use that title for it, they don't really give a name of their view, but this is what my characterization of the view is, that just as there are pagan creation myths in ancient Egypt and Mesopotamia, So this is an example of a Hebrew creation myth. They would say Genesis 1, verses 1 to Genesis 2, verse 3, is not to be taken literally. And they would rehearse the evidence against a literal interpretation of the text that we've already been through when we talked about the literal interpretation. And they would present and do present those same considerations that lead them to think that this text is not to be taken literally. Rather, they would say, or do say, that the key to correctly interpreting Genesis 1 is to compare it to Egyptian creation myths. They also examine Mesopotamian and Canaanite myths, but they find that these bear very few resemblances to the text of Genesis 1, and therefore are not really profitably consulted. There are few points of similarity between Mesopotamian and Canaanite creation myths and the story in Genesis 1. But, they observe, Israel was in Egypt in bondage for 400 years. And during that time, the Israelites had come to worship the Egyptian deities. Moses had to wean them off of these Egyptian deities and announce to them who the true God was, Yahweh. He was the real God. And even after they left Egypt in the Exodus, many of them were still keeping Egyptian gods and worshiping them. So that Egyptian religion had made deep inroads into the nation of Israel. And they believe that when we compare Genesis 1 to Egyptian creation myths, very significant similarities as well as significant differences emerge. And the differences will help us to see how Israel sought to create, how Israel sought to reject or correct these pagan myths that they had received while in Egypt. The similarities will show the connections with Egypt, but the stark differences will show the way in which Israel attempted to correct these pagan creation stories. Now, Miller and Soden point out that it is unfortunately very difficult to reconstruct just what the ancient Egyptian creation myth was. We have no single text, as we do of Genesis 1, which lays out the Egyptian view of creation. Rather, the Egyptian view of creation has to be cobbled together from all sorts of different texts over a couple of thousand years in order to try to sort out a sort of coherent view. They write, and I quote, "There is no single Egyptian account known to date that describes the complete Egyptian perspective on creation. Instead, we have to put together a mosaic of bits and pieces recorded in various documents. These documents represent a mixture of times and theologies covering more than two millennia, many of them in tension with one another, a situation that did not seem to bother the Egyptians. For the most part, Egyptian creation documents consist of brief statements and allusions scattered among many inscriptions, pyramid texts, coffin texts, the Book of the Dead, and other inscriptions." So we don't have a single coherent Egyptian creation myth. Rather, this is a reconstruction that scholars have made based upon a diversity of brief snippets and inscriptions over thousands of years. But on pages 78 to 80, they attempt to summarize the outlines of the Egyptian creation myth. And I will read this passage to you. "Before the beginning of creation, there was only an infinite, dark, watery, chaotic sea. There was nothing above the sea or below the sea. The sea was all there was. immersed in the sea, atom, or alternatively, re, or ammon, or ptah, the creator God and source of everything, brought himself into existence by separating himself from the waters. Egyptian cosmologies that view Amun as the creator, or even as one of the four initial qualities of the pre-creation matter, watery, unlimited, dark, imperceptible, from which creation emerges, would then also understand the wind to be present in the water, because Amun was also the god of wind. Since Atum, Amun, and Re are all connected with the sun, light was then in existence, even though the sun itself had not yet risen. While several means of creation are used interchangeably in the Egyptian accounts, including sneezing or spitting and masturbation, in many accounts, Atum, or one of the other gods noted above, spoke the universe into existence. This new creation, or universe, as conceived by the Egyptians, began with the separation of the waters to create the atmosphere, a bubble of air, known as the god Shu in the midst of this endless mass of water. Adam's command separated the surface of the waters in the sky from the earth. The waters receded and the first mound of earth appeared. The sun, already in the waters before the separation of the atmosphere, rose for the first time as the main event of creation. And so the basic universe was formed, a bubble of light, air, earth, and sky in the continuing infinity of dark, motionless water. The universe was actually composed of thousands of gods, all of which were part of Atum. In the Egyptian understanding, because all the elements and forces that a human being might encounter in this world are not impersonal matter and energy, but forms and wills of living beings, beings that surpass the merely human scale and are therefore gods. Into this universe, Adam commanded the creation of plants and animal life. Re formed man as his image. Khnum fashioned man on a potter's wheel with the breath of God, giving life to the image. In some accounts, man springs from the tears of the eye of Atum, the sun. After speaking into existence the universe and its millions of gods with their towns, shrines, and offerings, Ptah rested with everything in order. In Egyptian theology, all of creation was done in a single day, which was called the first occasion. So I think you can probably see from that account certain similarities as well as enormous differences between the Egyptian creation myth and the account found in Genesis 1. There are points of similarity. One thinks, for example, of the primeval waters, the darkness over the deep, and then the Spirit of God or the wind moving over the surface of the water. But then significant differences as well. And what Miller and Soden maintain is that the goal of the author of Genesis is not to correct so much the physical descriptions found in these Egyptian creation stories as in correcting their theology of creation. For example, you notice how the author of Genesis completely demythologizes the natural world, gets rid of all of these gods and goddesses, and instead has the single creator God who is the source of everything, is not himself self-created or comes out of the water, but is sovereign and transcendent. So what the goal of the narrative is not to correct the physical description so much as to correct the theology. This is what they write. In most cases, the biblical writer uses common motifs to demonstrate the stark differences in the Hebrew presentation of God. In other words, the considerable differences show that Genesis is not copying, but recasting the events of creation in order to argue strongly for a different theology. Now, when we meet next time, I will describe for you that theology as Miller and Soden understand it and show the ways in which the theology of creation in Hebrew understanding differs from the theology of creation in these Egyptian creation myths.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.